I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is the Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. This week, as the New South Wales COVID outbreak continues, we saw a record number of cases.
But regrettably, we also had quite a large increase in the number of cases overnight. So 239 cases of community transmission around at least...
With lockdowns extended for the next 4 weeks, millions of Australians who will remain without work are struggling to access the financial support they need. But with a little pressure from New South Wales...
Please know we fought our guts out for these extra payments. I'm glad they're here, and I do say that it will keep us going. People should not feel stressed about their financial position.
The Morrison government has increased its support for individuals and businesses.
And I just ask everybody not to suffer in silence, not to suffer at home. Please make sure you contact either Services Australia for individual payments or Services New South Wales.
Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Head of News Mike Tisher about the COVID disaster payments announced this week and whether it's too little, too late. It's Friday, the 30th of July. Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Gabs.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Lenore, do you want to bring us up to date on what those changes that were announced this week are?
Sure. So in brief, the disaster payments to individuals have now finally gone back to the level of payment that was offered under the JobKeeper in wave one of COVID.
We will be further increasing the levels of support provided to individuals as through the COVID disaster payment.
So people who've lost 20 hours of work or more a week are getting $750 now, and those who've lost between 8 and 20 hours are getting $450 a week.
In addition to that, we will be extending support to those who are on welfare payments.
The government has also announced payments of $200 a week for people on welfare payments who have lost more than 8 hours work a week on top of their welfare payment. So under this sort of incremental payments, as these have inched up over time, those people until this week had missed out altogether, and it was clearly a big hole in the system, but the government has filled that hole now.
The whole point of this is that people aren't able to earn that extra income they were earning. And these payments are there to support them.
There's also been new announcements around payments to businesses as well. So eligible businesses and not-for-profits will be paid somewhere between $1,500 and $100,000 a week. It's based on 40% of their payroll level. The maximum turnover threshold to get payments has been increased from $50 million to $250 million. But they have to show that they've suffered a drop in turnover of 30% or more, and sole traders will still get $1,000 a week. So this package of business payments is jointly funded by the federal and the state governments, unlike the original JobKeeper payments.
Gladys Berejiklian said that she had to fight hard to receive this additional funding from the federal government. Has Scott Morrison come to this a little bit reluctantly?
It certainly seems that way from the outside, and not just this payment, because just going back a few weeks, although every week seems like a month at this point, in the previous Victorian lockdown, or when it had just ended, Victorians were very disgruntled because it appeared that he'd been slightly more generous to New South Wales in the federal payments that were granted when it went into its lockdown. And then it took further time to then increase the amounts that have just announced this week because they were previously less generous. And also, as Lenore just mentioned, to include people on benefits who had previously been excluded from these payments if they were supplementing their benefits with casual work that they had subsequently lost. So there were a lot of people who were missing out on benefits who have now finally been included. But it does seem, whether it's from various states or just from groups campaigning for excluded groups to be included, typically the groups right at the bottom of the ladder, that it has each step has been a kind of painful extracting of, like pulling teeth from the Morrison government to make the payments fairer and also more effective in actually countering the pandemic.
To be fair to the government, I guess they probably were waiting to see how bad and how protracted this outbreak of Delta variant was and whether they needed to move to a payment system that, you know, needed to be there for the long or longer haul, which obviously it now does. So I guess if we're being fair to them, maybe some of the gradual ratcheting up of payments was a result of that.
That's very true. But as Alison Pennington of the Centre for Future Work pointed out in a really excellent opinion piece for us this week, it's not just a matter of fairness to the people who are receiving payments, for example, the people who need casual work and were supplementing their benefits. It's also, as was shown in the Victorian lockdown last year, this is one of the most effective tools we potentially have of stopping people moving about the city and potentially spreading the virus because they literally can't afford not to work.
Yeah, it's a public health measure too.
It's a reason why governments, both state and federal, should have been trying to do this right from the start of the outbreak because, as we've seen, the virus has spread massively in New South Wales. It seems to be out of control, the number of cases, and that is one reason they found in Victoria why that was so.
Where does that leave all the people on welfare payments who had less than 8 hours of work who won't be entitled to that $200 payment?
Well, it leaves them on the entirely inadequate job seeker payments that are now about $315 a week for singles or $256 a week if you're on youth allowance. We've been over and over and over the inadequacy of those payments. The argument from the government has always been they're meant to be transitional payments. Well, people on those payments certainly aren't going to get a job at the moment. They may have had their mutual obligation requirements suspended, but those payments are below subsistence levels and there will be gaps now, really big gaps forming between someone who was working, say, 8 or 9 hours a week and is getting the $200 and someone who'd been working less than that. And, you know, again, as Mike was just saying, even if you only care about public health outcomes, one thing that we've learned is that people stay at home if they can afford to. So in the first wave of COVID payments, the government did really dramatically increase JobSeeker. Then it went back to a level only barely above where it was before. That's where it's being left for now. And I do think that is one mistake in this latest iteration of payments. I think that that's a mistake both in terms of equity for those people, but also in terms of public health.
The new payment to business is called JobSaver. It's conspicuously different to JobKeeper, which they were determined not to bring back. But is this a good thing?
I mean, there were good things and bad things about JobKeeper. And the good things were it was rolled out pretty quickly and a lot of businesses have said that it was a lifesaver for their business during the lockdown last year. It was also good that it explicitly tied the employee to their employer so that they were just paid as they would have been had they still been working. And that has been severed in the new payment. So businesses are required to maintain the same overall staffing level, but that doesn't literally tie them to the individual employee. And so you could say that's a retrograde step. But on the other hand, there were also lots of problems with JobKeeper as it turned out, as it sort of the program unfolded, which was that businesses had to show an actual loss or predict a future loss to qualify for the payments. And as it turned out later, many who received JobKeeper, those losses did not eventuate. And they were just entitled to keep the extremely large payments that had been made to them. And also subsequently many paid bonuses to their executives and gave dividends to their shareholders and have been extremely reluctant to pay back JobKeeper, even where it has been shown that morally at least, if not legally, they should not have been entitled to it. So that was a very large sum of money.
We've done a lot of reporting on some of the so-called problems with JobKeeper, haven't we, Lenore?
Yeah, we have. Look, I mean, on the new program, whatever its Orwellian name is, about Job Saver, Job Wonder, Job whatever it is, the new program I actually think is better. I think there's enough of a connection, enough checks and balances on businesses to not reduce their payroll, and it gets around the big, big problem with JobKeeper, which was the eye-popping waste of money. $12.5 billion of the $90 billion that went out the door from JobKeeper in the first 3 months went to businesses that didn't need it, that didn't have any downturn at all, according to the Parliamentary Budget Office. $4.6 billion flowed to businesses whose turnover actually increased. I mean, you know, even if you take into account the fact that it's always tricky to get stimulus payments out the door quickly in, you know, massive emergencies, it's always a challenge. And Kevin Rudd certainly found that. But, you know, he got hammered for years and years for sending $900 stimulus checks to dead people. But, you know, if you looked at even the total possible wastage, if you like, from that measure, it might be $14 million. It's probably way less than that because a lot of those checks were never cashed or were returned. The wastage figure for JobKeeper is over $12 billion. I mean, this is next order.
Labor's Andrew Leigh pointed out, who helped to extract those figures, $12 billion could pay for 3 months of what he called properly run JobKeeper for New South Wales. So there's a direct kind of very obvious contrast between the willingness of the government to splurge these huge sums for businesses that don't need it and its extreme reluctance to spend it on very poorly paid people or people in casual work or on benefits who definitely do need it both for themselves and to control the pandemic.
And there's also a contrast between their willingness to kind of claw back these payments from very rich businesses compared to their willingness to claw back welfare payments from people who can least afford it.
So people will have seen from our extremely extensive reporting on the robo-debt scandal over many years that people on welfare benefits, the onus was on them to show that they were not entitled to their benefits and in many cases were plunged into extreme hardship as a result. And the contrast is extremely stark with the onus in this case, which is that businesses that didn't even technically end up fulfilling the requirements for the money are nevertheless allowed to keep it and there's no pressure on them to pay it back. So, yeah, I think people could reasonably draw the conclusion that there was a double standard at play there.
There's about 20 or more companies that have said they'll pay it back, often publicly listed companies who might come under pressure from their shareholders. But there's some companies that are just saying, no, they're not going to, like Harvey Norman's refusing to pay back $22 million in JobKeeper payments, even though it doubled its profits in the second half of last year. And, you know, when there was a public outcry about that, they just shut down their social media accounts, which is, you know, one way to go about it. We've been publishing stories about rich public schools that got JobKeeper and then offered parents a discount on their school fees. You know, at the same time that universities didn't get any JobKeeper and are laying off thousands and thousands of staff. I mean, there was just so many inequities in the first scheme that it's, you know, really bears a lot of scrutiny, I think.
The United States and New Zealand both had public registers of people who received their equivalent payments of JobKeeper. Would something like that help avoid some of these, what's been called rorting?
Yeah, I think it would. I mean, the Greens have got a bill before Parliament at the moment to try to force companies to pay back JobKeeper if they were profitable and didn't need it. I do think it's a bit fraught to add that requirement retrospectively, but New Zealand's got this publicly searchable database where you can see what companies received wage subsidies and for how many employees they were made. You can even look up whether your boss claimed it for you. And I think that level of transparency would really put pressure on companies who received it and then used it to pay massive bonuses to their executives or dividends or, you know, just, you know, trouser the money effectively. I think that would be a really good idea.
The federal government was criticised at the beginning of the pandemic for coming kicking and screaming to these payments, and we've seen a little bit of that now, but they have come to the table. Are these new payments enough, and will it help New South Wales avoid the worst of a potential recession?
I think that the payments now are good and well-structured and better than the first time round, apart from that glaring hole, that glaring problem with welfare recipients who hadn't been earning, working for more than 8 hours a week. I think that is still a really big problem. But I think other than that, it should get New South Wales through. I guess, you know, the government is hoping it might also make sure that New South Wales, the biggest state economy in the country, doesn't pull the whole country back into recession. And it's about $1 billion a week stimulus, $750 million from the federal government. And they're also offering a business package to Victoria. So that's more stimulus. And I think the government, you know, given that if the economy did go back into a recession, it would be just before the election that has to be held by next May. I think they're really hoping, A, that it helps New South Wales through, and B, that it also means that the economy doesn't suffer that fate.
As far as the impacts on the pandemic are concerned, though, it all feels very late, doesn't it? That rather than standing up at the press conference every day and berating people for not mixing with their families or going to work when they shouldn't, or going out of their areas when they shouldn't, and deploying the police to patrol communities, it might have been better if these payments had come earlier for the communities that really needed them, in southwest Sydney in particular.
Yeah, and I liked the way the Prime Minister said this week he didn't really care who got the credit for these payments.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think he does.
He said it a few times. I think he repeated it.
Yeah, I reckon he does.
Next, internet wormholes and three little pigs. Okay, that brings us to what you can't get out of your head. And we did promise listeners last week that we would come with some cheerful stories. So, Lenore, have we kept our promise?
I've kept my promise, Gabs. I have. The story I couldn't get out of my head, and I really couldn't, is a new series of stories that our culture desk is getting together called Internet Wormhole, where they ask people to write about some sort of rabbit hole, wormhole they've gone down online. And the first one is about famous people who take you on a video tour of their homes. I didn't know this was a thing, but apparently it's a thing. And some of them are quite weird, like the Robert Downey Jr. one was a bit weird.
Hi, we're the Downeys. This is Susan's house. The reason that it's situated exactly where it is because they want to be able to see that church spire back in the late 19th century. I can't tell you which direction we are from the church because that would be security breach. Please come in.
But then there was one by Carla Delevingne, who Google informs me is an English singer, model and actress. I did kind of know who she was, although pop culture is really not my area of expertise.
Hi, guys. We've met before, right? Hi, AD. I'm Carla Delevingne and welcome to my house. Leo, come on.
Anyway, this one is bizarre beyond anything I can describe. She has something in her house she calls a vagina tunnel. Don't even ask. You have to watch it. It's bizarre.
This is my vagina tunnel. Shall I go through? I'm going to go through. Oh, God. And then you're inside. You want to come in, Alfie? Come on, baby. I come in here to think. I come in here to create. I feel inspired.
I kind of like the fact that she didn't take herself entirely seriously. But it was very strange. I don't think I'm the target audience for these kinds of things, but in terms of, you know, insight into stuff that goes on online, it was really quite something.
You're not going to build a vagina tunnel in the office when we eventually get back, Lenore?
No, Gabs, I'm not.
Mike, can you top that?
I don't know if I can top it, but I think I've also kept my promise, and I hope also that I have got something more practical that we can bring to the office if we ever get back. So people may remember this time last year, there was a great story that came out of Germany of a woman had taken a picture of a naked man. So obviously, preface, in Germany, it's completely normal for people to sunbathe naked in the middle of summer in public parks and so on. So she took a picture of a naked man who was chasing a wild boar, and it's two cubs, no, not cubs, you know, it's two offspring.
Piglets.
Piglets, thank you. Carrying a bag, a yellow bag, which had his laptop in it, and sort of this slightly, largish man wearing nothing, chasing a wild boar through a public park. It was absolutely hilarious. Anyway, now, a company that makes accessories for model railways has made figurines depicting this scene quite accurately, actually. It's quite good.
So you could kind of buy them and put them beside your Thomas the Tank Engine kind of thing.
Exactly. Well, I think it's probably a bit more sophisticated than Thomas the Tank Engine. Mm. It's probably like, you know, extremely realistic reconstructions of very complicated rail systems that some people do. But also the woman who took the photograph is not happy about it because she's nothing from the photo, and other people now are. But I mean, if I were her, just the satisfaction of having taken such a beautifully composed picture that's given so much joy to so many people would, you know, you could kind of retire on that.
It'd be your contribution to humankind. Yeah.
So she wasn't paid for all the places it was put in publications.
She said she didn't earn any money from it at all.
Oh.
We were wondering whether we could construct a model of the two naked sunbathers chased by the deer in the park.
That would be...
You know, as an Australian contribution to the genre.
That would be amazing. I just want to add my joy for the week, which has been solely focused on the Olympic swimming, and I just have loved seeing Ariane Titmus beat the world's best female swimmer, Katie Ledecky, and all the other female swimmers as well, and male swimmers and rowers. You know, whoever's winning, I'm happy. It's a good distraction. Thank you so much for joining us today, Lenore.
Thanks, Gabs.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Gabs.
Today's episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Joe Koning. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday, and we'll see you then.